So I've just got a first question. Just tell us a bit about yourself and your background for those who perhaps don't know who you are.
Thank you. My name is Sam. I live in Maidenhead, which isn't Maidstone before you accuse me of living in Kent. I wasn't raised in a kind of church-going family, so didn't really engage with the Christian faith until I was kind of 17 years old. And a friend of mine invited me to his church's youth group. I didn't really want to go, but I couldn't think of a reason not to go quick enough, so agreed to go, and heard there a brief explanation of the gospel. I'd never heard it before, and I suddenly realised that Jesus was both much more compelling and much less easy than I had imagined he would be. And both those things intrigued me, so I started to think for myself about his teaching, started to go along regularly to hear more about his teaching. Eventually came to faith in Christ around the time of my 18th birthday. So been a Christian for quite a few years now.
Great. And tell us what you do now exactly.
Yes, I have been in kind of local church pastoral ministry for the last 10 or 15 years. For the last 3 years, I've been working for a ministry called the Zacharias Trust, which exists to try to engage with the big questions and objections that people have about the Christian faith today. So I spent a lot of time trying to deal with some of those kinds of questions, and we're trying to give as compelling a response to those issues as we can do.
Great. Well, you should have a handout so you can follow both the talks. Which colour handout will we be using first?
We are yellow.
A yellow handout for this talk. Feel free to take notes. I'm going to hand over to Sam. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming. You could be outside enjoying the sunshine, but you came here. Just a couple of things to mention. You will have possibly underneath you one of these little pieces of paper in case you think the organisers are being very generous and giving you a high-end bookmark as a free gift. This is just a drop-down question, so we thought we'd do the questions written so that sometimes with these issues like this we can feel a bit self-conscious about asking certain things. So if a question comes to mind at any point during my talk, you just want to sit and write a shopping list, make the most of that, and then at some point we'll be collecting those in and having a go at answering them. There's also a great bookstore there. A couple of books I wanted to mention in particular. And if you get these books and read them now, you don't need to listen to what I'm saying. So that could be another incentive. What Does the Bible Really Teach About Homosexuality? Is a really helpful book going through the kind of key passages of the Bible that kind of touch on this issue. Very kind of careful, looking at what they say, looking at what they don't say, and setting that in a kind of wider framework of what God says on these issues more generally. So that's a very helpful book if you want to go a bit deeper in some of the Bible texts. This book is called The Plausibility Problem, and really it's looking at what we're going to be addressing in the second talk, which is what can the church be doing to help on these kinds of issues and questions. And the thesis of the book is that there are a number of ways in which the church has unwittingly made this issue harder to deal with than it needed to be, in terms of our church culture and all sorts of other things. So that would be a great book. Actually, it would be a great book for you to read. It would be a great book for you to get your pastor, if your pastor hasn't read it, and to discuss, as you know, I think church leaders should be discussing the sorts of issues that Ed Shaw raises. So those would be two books. Everything on the bookstore is brilliant, and it's all cheap. So if you miss someone's Christmas present, now's the time to make up for that. So in this session, we're thinking about why Jesus is good news for our gay friends. I wanted to call it that because I think many of us slightly fear that Jesus might not be good news for gay people. We tend to think, well, I know how he's good news for me, but is Christianity still good news for people who are gay? Is it just going to be one long message of unremitting condemnation and negativity? And so I wanted to kind of start with this point to try and, I hope, convince you that whoever we are, Jesus is always great news for us. Just a bit about my own kind of background on this issue. I became a Christian when I turned 18. Around the time I turned 17, I kind of was just beginning to come to terms with the fact that I was attracted to guys and not girls. It took me a few years of being a dopey teenager to figure that out. It was a very different world then. The issues of homosexuality just weren't on the table in the way that they are now. And so it was less obvious me to kind of reach that conclusion quickly. But I gradually began to realise that the romantic and sexual feelings for girls that my friends were constantly talking about, I didn't share. And instead was beginning to realise that some of those feelings I was experiencing towards one or two of my friends themselves. So I was just beginning to come to terms with that. I then ended up, as I said, becoming a Christian. And so one of the big questions, therefore, that was suddenly urgent for me as a new disciple was, well, what does Jesus think about this issue of sexuality? And I didn't know. I just knew that I wanted to follow Jesus. I knew that he was going to do a much better job of running my life than I was. And therefore, whatever he said was going to be okay because it's Jesus saying it. And so what I want to do in these next few minutes is to share three brief scriptures in Matthew's Gospel that just give us the basic coordinates of what Jesus has to say on this whole issue. So if you've got a Bible, either open it or switch it on, depending on what your age is and technological familiarity. And find your way. We're going to start in Matthew 5. I didn't put that one on the handout because I didn't think of it till yesterday. Why you should never do a handout. But Matthew chapter 5, a fairly well-known passage from the Sermon on the Mount, but very, very pertinent to our discussion on this. So Matthew chapter 5, verse 27, Jesus is speaking and he says, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery." Okay, you shall not commit adultery is one of the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament. So people have heard that commandment a ton. So Jesus is saying, you've heard that it says you shall not commit adultery. So far, so good. Then he says, verse 28, "But I say to you," in other words, Jesus is saying, this is what you've heard so far, but I'm going to take it a bit further. Jesus says, "I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So up until then, people have taken the commandment not to commit adultery as meaning, well, as long as I don't physically commit adultery, I'm fine. So as long as I haven't physically done that, I've obeyed the commandment. And so a lot of people would be thinking, well, I've not committed adultery, therefore that's 1 out of 10. I'm good on that one. So whatever, however I do on the other 9, I've got this one to fall back on. Haven't committed adultery, I'm good. Jesus says, actually, no, that the kind of the ultimate goal of that commandment isn't just that you don't commit physical adultery, it's actually taking you somewhere deeper. So Jesus says it's not just about your physical behaviour. It's about your attitude, it's about your heart. It's about what you do even in your own mind. It's even about how you look at someone. And whereas we tend to make the distinction between, well, I can think about it as long as I don't do it, Jesus is saying thinking about it is a form of doing it. And so he says, anyone who looks at someone with lustful intent has already committed adultery in their heart. Here's the good news behind that commandment. The good news is Jesus thinks that your sexual integrity is so precious that it must not be violated even in the privacy of someone else's mind. And similarly, someone else's sexual integrity matters so much that that mustn't be compromised even in the privacy of your own mind. And it's hugely relevant to us because our culture, I think, is trying to do two contradictory things at the same time around this issue. On one hand, it's saying, listen, if you can't live a life of sexual fulfillment, you can't really be a proper, real, fulfilled human being. That if someone can't be sexually fulfilled, they're being condemned to this kind of shriveled existence where they're not really leading a healthy, full life. So on that sense, we're kind of saying sex is everything. if you're depriving someone of the kind of sex they want, you really are away something essential. But on the other hand, we're also saying, oh, it's just a physical act, why does it matter? Why should God care what I do with my genitals? When we look at the universe as a whole, when we look at the injustice in the world, when we look at the needs of other people, why, I mean, honestly, why should we have hang-ups about sex? It's just sex. It's just a physical appetite, like being hungry is a physical appetite. So we're kind of saying it's both everything and it's also not really much at all. Jesus is saying that actually it really does matter. It matters hugely. God has given us sexuality as human beings for a very, very significant reason. And therefore it matters what we do with our sexuality, and it matters what others do to our sexuality, even if we don't know they're doing it. I think we sense that as a culture, don't we? That the recent Me Too movement has shone a spotlight on sexual abuse in huge areas of contemporary life. And as we listen to some of the testimonies of victims of sexual abuse, we realise it's not just physical. When someone is sexually assaulted, they are being violated in the kind of core of their humanity. It means something. It's not just a physical act, like shaking hands is a physical act. It matters far, far more than that. And we sense that. And Jesus' commandment reflects that. We need to steward our and other people's sexuality very, very carefully indeed. Now, I want to start there because Jesus is immediately showing us that actually all of us fall very far short of his standards. If we're taking it as Jesus takes it, to the level of how we look and the level of how we think, all of us have fallen very, very far short of Jesus' standards. So let's just acknowledge right from the get-go, quite apart from issues of same-sex sexuality, Jesus' teaching convicts, challenges and humbles every single one of us. All of us have failed in this area of life. All of us actually have some quite significant repenting that we need to do in this area of life. So Jesus levels the playing field. There may be certain forms of sexual expression and sexual desire that some of us may never have entertained, but that doesn't mean we're off the hook. So that's the first thing to see in Matthew chapter 5. The second passage is Matthew chapter 15. If you want to turn that up, Matthew 15 verses 19 and 20. Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, and what we need to know about the Pharisees is they really believed in the reality of sin, and to the Pharisees sin was a bit like an infection. And so just as we're living in that time of year where people are beginning to cough and splutter and come down with various viruses, and we can kind of see that around us, a really good friend of mine who lives just around the corner from me back home, I needed to drop something off for him a couple of days ago. So I've messaged him saying, hey, when do you want me to drop it round? He said, I'll come round any time. Oh, by the way, I've got the flu, but come round anyway and just hang out. And I was thinking, okay, I've got a really busy week coming up. I don't have time to get ill. So I will pop round and drop off what I need to drop off, but I'll kind of quarantine myself as I do so, hand over the goods, and then immediately get out of there because I just don't want to get sick this week. And that's kind of how the Pharisees regarded sin. They're thinking there's this spiritual infection out there. We want to avoid all the contagions of it. So the Pharisees had this very kind of clear system of there are certain people and places and things that were spiritual contagions. So avoid those and you'll stay spiritually healthy. And Jesus says something here that completely destroys that way of thinking. Jesus says in verse 19, "For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander." So Jesus is saying, you're partially right. There is such a thing as sin. There is this spiritual infection that's out there. But where you are catastrophically wrong is where the contagion is to be found. The Pharisees were assuming it's out there and we need to avoid it. Jesus is saying, no, it's in your heart and you need to acknowledge it. So if you want to avoid spiritual contamination, Jesus says you need to avoid your own heart. I saw someone on Twitter the other day, their Twitter profile said, "If I could unfollow myself, I would." And it's that kind of thing. Jesus is saying, listen, if you really want to avoid sin, you've got a problem with yourself here. But I want to suggest that what Jesus says in that verse is just as devastating for our own culture today, because our culture tends to tell us that if you want to flourish as you, if you want to be the real, true, authentic, fully orbed, whole you, then you need to look deep down inside your heart and you need to discover who you truly are, and then you need to live out that true self and identity. Everybody else's job to accept it, your job to discover it. If you've watched any Disney movie in the last 10 years, that is the message. You have to be true to yourself. No one else can tell you who you are. You've got to figure that out on your own, and you must be true to it. But Jesus is saying, listen, if you look deep down inside your heart, you're not going to find the answer to your angst. You're going to find the cause of it. Because your heart, deep down, is not right. What comes out of the heart, Jesus says, is evil. And he gives just a sampling of some of the kind of symptoms of a heart that isn't right. He talks about evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. That's just a sampling. Some of the evidences of a heart that is not spiritually healthy. One of the things Jesus lists there, we have translated as sexual immorality. The Greek word that Matthew wrote in his gospel is the word porneia. That's actually where we get the word pornography from. That literally meant, at Jesus' time, any sexual behaviour outside the covenant of marriage. So it would have included sex before marriage. It would have included adultery, which Jesus also lists separately as well. Would have included prostitution. And in the first century Jewish context Jesus was speaking in, it would have included any kind of same-sex behaviour as well. That had been prohibited by the Old Testament. So Jesus is saying any sexual behaviour outside of marriage isn't right. It's not the only thing that isn't right. He talks about slander and theft and false witness and all kinds of other things too. It's not uniquely wrong, but it is wrong. And I mention that just because one of the kind of myths that we often hear today is that Jesus was just kind of laid back when it comes to sexual ethics. You know, the Old Testament was medieval, so we can just ignore that. Paul in the New Testament, depending on which side of bed he got out of, was either kind of liberating or totally not. So you kind of, you know, got to figure that out. But Jesus was kind of, he was just kind of chilled out on all of this. He wasn't bothered, and therefore we shouldn't be bothered. But Jesus actually has really challenging things to say. He doesn't take the Old Testament sexual ethic and then kind of roll his eyes and go, wow, we're not in those days anymore. He actually intensifies it. He makes it more challenging. Plenty of other strands of Old Testament where he said, listen, this was in place for a particular time that we're no longer in. But when it comes to sexual ethics, Jesus not only doesn't shove it all to one side, but he actually applies it in a far deeper level than people have previously taken it. The final passage here is Matthew chapter 19 and verses 3 and following. One of the most significant passages in the Bible, I think, on this whole kind of topic and area. Jesus again is talking to the Pharisees. They're trying to pick a fight with him in verse 3. They come up to Jesus and they're trying to test him. They're trying to get him in a kind of gotcha moment. So they say to him, is it lawful to divorce your wife for any cause? Some Jewish rabbis were teaching that very thing, that whatever your wife does that just irritates you, divorce her, that's fine. So they're trying to get Jesus in on this issue just to see where he lands. And they're thinking whatever he says, they can then use against him. So can you divorce your wife for any cause? Jesus answers in verse 4 by saying, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. Now, lots of stuff going on in there. The first thing Jesus is doing is he's poking fun at them. Okay, Pharisees prided themselves on how thoroughly they knew the scriptures. They memorized swathes of the Old Testament. Passages that many of us struggle to read once, they knew off by heart. And then Jesus says to them in verse 4, haven't you read, and then quotes from page 1 of the Old Testament. He quotes Genesis 1. He who created them from the beginning made them male and female. So Jesus is saying, listen, when you started your kind of scriptural study, did you make it as far as, I don't know, page 1? Did you get that far in your studies? So he's kind of poking fun at them. But notice what else he's doing. They ask a question about divorce. Jesus answers in verse 4 by quoting Genesis 1 and then goes on in verse 5 to quote from Genesis 2. And Jesus is saying, in effect, listen, you've asked me about divorce, but you're not going to understand divorce unless you understand marriage. And by starting where he does in Genesis 1, he's also saying, you're not going to understand marriage unless you understand gender. So Jesus' starting point isn't just, listen, marriage is when person A gets together with person B and then they just see how it goes. Jesus has a much deeper and richer definition of marriage. It's not just any two human beings in any combination expressing romantic affection for each other. Jesus is saying actually that the foundational truth behind marriage is that God has made us male. So he puts that bit down first and says, God has made us male and female. And then verse 5, therefore we have this thing called marriage. Marriage exists because our sexual difference as men and women exists. Because God has made us male and female, we have marriage. That's not saying that because God has made us male and female, we all have to be married. Jesus was unmarried when he was saying this. But it does mean we can only be married because God has made us male and female. Now that is, I don't need to tell you, extraordinarily offensive to our culture. And that can be quite unsettling. So let me just say that actually the reason Jesus' teaching on marriage seems so countercultural to us today is because Jesus' teaching on marriage has been countercultural in every single culture for one reason or another. It's not that human society has been tracking with Jesus up until 15 years ago. And now it doesn't, and so we're in this new kind of era of, well, society's not with us on this, so we need to totally rethink everything. No, Jesus' teaching has always been controversial. It has always gone against the grain of any one society's way of thinking about sexual ethics. No time to kind of go into this now, but if you look at the Roman Empire's kind of understanding of sexuality, marriage, sexual ethics, this teaching was utterly revolutionary. It was just unheard of. Christians believed things no one else believed. And so it's no surprise to see that actually this teaching feels so out of place in our own culture as well. We would expect it to if it comes actually from outside of all human culture, if it comes from God himself. Does that make sense? So Jesus talks about the two becoming one flesh and unpacks it a bit more. Down in verse 10, the disciples kind of freak out and say, if such is the case of a man and his wife, it's better not to marry. They're kind of saying, Jesus, this kind of sounds serious. This is a bit like commitment. This whole one flesh thing. Maybe let's not marry. Really interesting, isn't it? When Jesus teaches on marriage, part of the response is people saying, maybe it's better not to marry. Note to self and any other preachers in the room, when we preach on marriage, if we never get that response, the question is, are we teaching marriage in the way that Jesus does? So the disciples kind of freak out, maybe it's better not to marry. Jesus doesn't then say, you know what, you're absolutely right, this is why it's good to live together for a bit first. No, Jesus responds by talking about eunuchs. Jesus responds by talking about people who were celibate for one reason or another. So Jesus is saying, in other words, that the only godly alternative to being married is to be not just single and therefore playing the field, but to be sexually abstinent entirely. So that is what Jesus teaches. That sex outside of the covenant of marriage is sinful. It's not the only thing that is, but it is one of the things that is. That marriage is between a man and a woman. And that the only godly alternative to that is to be sexually pure, which includes not just what you do with your body, but what you do with your mind. The sign that we've understood Jesus' teaching on this is that every single one of us is deeply challenged by it. If we look at the teaching of Jesus on sexual ethics and we point to one group of people and say, those guys have really messed this up, we've not missed just how deeply it challenges ourselves. So why is that Jesus' teaching? Is this, you know, why does it have to be this way? Is this just some unfair, arbitrary line Jesus has drawn in the sand for no good reason? Which brings us to our second point on the handout, which is the meaning of marriage. This is not just, I need to draw a line somewhere and I've just randomly decided to draw it here. There's a rationale to why this is the Bible's sexual ethic. So let me just point out that the Bible begins with a marriage and the Bible ends with a marriage. It begins with the marriage of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. It ends with the marriage in the book of Revelation between Jesus and the church. And so marriage, if you like, forms the bookends to the Bible. And what we begin to realise as we look at the Bible is that first marriage is meant to point to the last marriage. It's like a movie trailer for it. It's a good question to ask. You read Genesis 1, you see the account of creation, it's all large-scale, epic, special effects-y. There's species and planets and ecosystems being created. And then Genesis 2 happens, and we should find this jarring and odd, but it's so familiar we don't notice it. But we're suddenly in a garden watching a guy and a girl get together. We should be thinking, why are we here? Why is this the beginning? And the answer the rest of the Bible gives us is that this man and woman who've been literally made for each other, these guys getting together is a picture of what the whole Bible is going to be about. The union of male and female points to the eventual union of heaven and earth. Because just as that man and that woman are made for each other and belong together, so too do heaven and earth. And as the Bible unfolds, we realise that God is not just the big power centre in the sky. He calls himself a husband. He's a groom. He's someone who, when he expresses and sets his love on people, he can't stop himself from making amazing vows to them. Amazing covenantal promises. And again, as the Old Testament unfolds, we realise God's people are not just his groupies, his fan base, his subjects. They are also his bride, his beloved. Often, sadly, in the Old Testament, they're his wayward bride. When Jesus turns up in the New Testament, one of the first things he calls himself in Mark's Gospel is the bridegroom. He says, the bridegroom has come. I am that divine husband in the Old Testament. And so Jesus is saying, listen, my arrival means it's time to start putting some rings on some fingers here. That's what I've come to do. And so the rest of the New Testament then expresses our faith in Jesus in very marital language. So Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, he again talks about how in Genesis 2, the two will become one flesh. And then he follows it up by saying in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 17, he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. So just as the woman is joined to the man and becomes one flesh, so the believer is joined to Jesus and becomes one spirit. There's a parallel there. Again, in Ephesians chapter 5, Paul is talking to husbands and wives, and then he kind of steps back and says, guys, I'm actually talking about Jesus and the church. That's what this whole thing has been about all this time. And then again, at the end of Revelation, we finally have the marriage supper of the Lamb and his bride, the church. We have the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven to earth as a bride adorned for a husband. So marriage is not incidental to the Bible. Marriage, if you like, is the wraparound concept for the whole Bible. The whole story of the Bible is marital, which is why we can't fiddle about with our definition of marriage without doing violence to the whole grain of Scripture. And it's why Christians have the particular view of marriage that we do. If marriage is meant to picture Christ in the church, then marriage has to be covenantal. It's not just contractual. It's not just, well, as long as you make me feel romantically fulfilled, and as long as I make you feel romantically fulfilled, if we both keep our end of the bargain, then we'll stay together, but the moment we don't, we're off. No, it's based on promises. It's not based on merely present romantic infatuation. It's based on promises. That's why Christians believe that it's not appropriate for a Christian to marry outside the faith, because our human marriage is meant to be an expression of and a reflection of our spiritual marriage in Jesus. It's why for Christians, marriage has to be between like and unlike, between male and female, because it's picturing Christ and the church. It's picturing heaven and earth. Two different but deeply complementary parties that belong together. And it also means that Christians believe, or should believe, that if marriage reflects our relationship with Jesus, then our marriage on earth is not ultimate. Actually, it's a picture of the thing that is ultimate. So if I can put it this way, your marriage is not meant to fulfill you. It's meant to point to the relationship that will fulfill you. So I sometimes give talks to students, and I'll often say to them, listen, if you marry someone because you think that person is going to meet all of your emotional, sexual, romantic, and social needs, you're going to be a nightmare to be married to. Because that person was not designed by God to carry that burden. It means, this is an aside, but when I occasionally get to take weddings, and one of my conditions now is, I will only take a couple's wedding on the condition that they don't write their own vows. Because in my experience, when a couple writes their own vows, the vows they write almost entirely miss the point of a marriage ceremony. It's always about how they feel now. We know how you feel now. We don't need 17 verses of bad poetry to know that you guys are really into each other right now. What we need to know is, what are your intentions for each other? What are you going to do in 25 years' time when she's been diagnosed with cancer? That's what we need to know now. What are you promising? So this view of marriage, that it points ultimately to Christ and the church, means that we don't demean marriage, we don't trivialise it, we don't treat it lightly, but nor do we idolise it and worship it. It matters, but precisely because it's pointing to the thing that matters the most and isn't itself that thing. So I don't appreciate hearing a Christian on his or her wedding day saying something of his spouse that a Christian should only ever say of Jesus. I remember one guy I know, lovely Christian lady that he was getting married to, and he said at one point, "Do you know what? She's the light of my world." And I remember thinking, that sounds romantic, and that's going to get you some brownie points with someone, but you're not loving her by saying things of her that are only true of Jesus, because Jesus didn't put her on the planet to be the light of your world. That job's already been taken. So this teaching on marriage is not arbitrary. It's not just God being pernickety for the sake of it. In fact, what Jesus says in Matthew 19 reflects something I think we quite often get wrong as Christians. We tend to think, well, marriage is only between a man and a woman because two people of the same sex can't really love each other properly like a heterosexual couple can. Jesus is saying nothing here about the strength of feelings. He's talking about the type of union that results. It is that the man and the woman who uniquely form a one flesh union that itself points to that union we have with Jesus. I can think of a number of gay couples that I know that are deeply faithful and committed to each other. And I can point to a number of heterosexual couples I know where the marriage is in pieces. It's not the strength or quality of the feelings Jesus is commenting on here. It's the type of union, the significance of the union that can result from it. Does that make sense? Well, that kind of may give us a bit more of a rationale for why the Bible says some of the things it does, but it still leaves that question lurking in the back of our mind. It still sounds like it's kind of sucks for gay people. So I want to spend the rest of the time in this first session on the goodness of God. When I became a Christian and when I first became acquainted with the teaching of Jesus on sexual ethics, it kind of forced me into a decision. Am I going to continue with Jesus now that I know what he teaches, or am I going to try to fulfill my own sexuality? I knew I couldn't do both at the same time. I thought that would just lack integrity to say I follow Jesus whilst not following him. So the question was, okay, which way am I going to go? Sexual fulfillment or Jesus? And to our culture today, to choose Jesus is the most ridiculous thing someone can do. You've got a choice between fulfilling your sexual feelings or following a religious leader and a very old book. And for most people today, that's just a no-brainer. It's not only idiocy to choose Jesus over your sexuality, it's probably bad for you. This is probably harmful. So let me give three reasons why I did and do make the decision that I have been making. The first is to do with who Jesus is. This sounds a bit like a cop-out. It isn't. Truly, it isn't. But the fact is that when we understand who Jesus truly is to us, it makes complete sense why we would follow him, even if it means we can't fulfill our sexuality. So one of the things I have to say to non-Christian friends of mine who kind of think I'm a bit weird for making the life decisions I've made is that is only going to make sense when you realise who Jesus is to me. And if Jesus is who he says he is, it makes complete sense to go with him on this. And what I began to realise, even as a young disciple, was that Jesus knows me far, far better than I know myself. The reason for that is Jesus made me. He created me. He came up with the idea of me to start with. So of course he knows me far, far better than I know myself. Moreover, I began to realise Jesus loves me more than I love myself. And he's more committed to my ultimate joy than even I am, to the extent that he's willing to open up his veins for me. If those things are true, I would be an idiot not to follow him. A friend of mine has a saying on the wall of her office that is, I have no idea where it comes from, but I love it. It says, those who hear not the music think the dancer's mad. It's true. If you watch a music video and take off the volume, it's a bit weird. There's lots of strutting and pouting and other weird things going on. You put the music back on, it starts to make sense. The Christian life does not make sense unless people hear the music. Unless people get who Jesus Christ is. It's why if someone, this occasionally happens, I've had people come up to me and say, listen, you just can't believe what you believe about marriage today. You've got to change your views on this. My response is to say, listen, I believe what I believe on this issue because I believe what I believe about Jesus. So you may not realise you're doing this, but by telling me to change my beliefs, you're actually telling me I need to stop following Jesus Christ. Are you quite prepared to go on record as saying you have the authority to tell people to stop following Jesus? If you do think you have that authority, can you tell me what you have going for you that Jesus doesn't have going for him, such that I should follow your advice on this and not his? And by the way, he died and rose again, so that's the standard here. So who Jesus is the first thing. Second thing is how Jesus calls all of us. Because of what Jesus says about our hearts, one of the implications of that is if sin isn't just certain discrete acts that we might or might not perform, actually sin is in our hearts deep down. It means sin taints and touches every single area of life because it comes from the centre. And therefore there is no area of life where we are everything that we should be. There's no area of life where we can say, do you know what, I don't need Jesus for that. I'm completely fine in that area of life. So that means just in the issue of human sexuality, again, as we saw at the beginning, all of us are in the same boat. All of us have certain sexual feelings we're going to have to say no to if we're going to be faithful to Jesus. It's going to be costly for any of us to follow him in this area of life. Jesus didn't come down to this earth, gather up all the heterosexual people and say to them, well done, guys, well done, that's brilliant work. As you were, keep going, thank you very much, off you go now. And then gather all the people who are non-heterosexual and say to them, well, yeah, I'm really sorry, but we've got a bit of a problem here. Now, Jesus' words, I hope we've seen, are deeply challenging and convicting for all of us. So it's going to be costly for any of us to follow him in the area of sexuality. But it's more than that, because someone said to me once, say, are you saying Jesus wants to be in control of my sexuality? And I said, no, actually, Jesus wants far more than that. He's only just getting started. He wants your life and your heart and your soul. He not only thinks he has the right to demand everything of you, he believes that he's worthy of being given your whole life. And so he says, doesn't he, in Mark chapter 8, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Key word in that verse is the word anyone. There's no one who can skip that part. For anyone to come to Jesus, they must deny self. That's massively costly. Jesus is saying all of us are going to have to say a deep and profound no to some of our greatest longings and yearnings and ambitions in life. Jesus goes on to say that if you try to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you lose your life for my sake and the gospel, he says, you'll gain it. So in other words, Jesus, he's beautifully honest and upfront about this. Jesus is saying, listen, if you become my disciple, there are going to be times when it feels like I'm killing you. When it feels like I'm just taking life from you. And yet the very process of my doing that is what is actually giving you life. It's one of those amazing paradoxes in the Christian life that all the things that feel like they are unbearable costs are totally worth it. And the beautiful thing is, the more we deny self and follow Jesus, the more we end up becoming our true selves. The more I follow Jesus, it's not the case that I just become less and less me. No, the self I'm denying is the distorted self. And the more I press on with Jesus, the more I become the me that he thought up in the first place. I don't know how he pulls this off. I just know that he does. But if you take 10 Christians and make all of them more like Jesus, they'll become more like Jesus without becoming more like each other. But each of them will become more like their true selves. Does that make sense? Isn't that amazing? That's how Jesus calls all of us. Massive, unimaginable cost that is just totally, totally worth it. So let me say, if you think the cost of discipleship for LGB people is too high, I want to suggest that you think the cost of discipleship for anyone is too high. And that it may well be a sign that you've not really counted the cost of discipleship in your own life. Someone said to me once, yeah, but the gospel's harder for you because it goes against who you are. And I remember thinking, well, I don't think my sexual feelings are who I am. But more importantly, if you think the gospel of Jesus has somehow slotted into your life quite neatly, I don't think it's the gospel of this Jesus you've received. So I began to realise, as a young Christian, I could see what the cost of discipleship was going to look like in this particular area of life. And yet I realised that this is the same deal for everyone. It'll pinch in slightly different areas for each one of us in terms of what we both, you know, what each of us regards as being the big non-negotiable for us. But all of us, Jesus makes the same demands of. And then the final thing is what Jesus offers. Jesus, if you remember, says that he's the bread of life. He says, whoever comes to me shall not go hungry, whoever believes in me shall never thirst. So Jesus is saying that he is the only one who can bring ultimate, lasting satisfaction. In other words, he is saying that he is to your soul what bread is to a starving stomach and what water is to a parched tongue. And so when someone says to me, listen, okay, I get that we're sinners, I get that Jesus died for us, I get that we need to kind of, you know, make some adjustments to follow him, but I cannot accept a Jesus who tells me who to sleep with. That tells me that the freedom to sleep with who they want to sleep with has become their functional bread of life. If that's the thing they can't do without, it means that that's the thing they think their life most needs, which is why it's suddenly become the non-negotiable. I said I do a lot with students. I meet countless students who are, frankly, they're having the kind of sex they want to have, and they're having the amount of that sex they want to have as well. And culture is saying to them, this is as good as it gets, and it doesn't feel that good. And it's because however good a gift sex and marriage can be in the appropriate contexts, They're not designed to satisfy. Only Jesus can satisfy. Which means whatever you lose in life, if you get Jesus, you've hit the jackpot. You really have won the life lottery. It doesn't matter what it costs you. If you get Jesus, you're not ultimately losing out. So there are times, if I'm honest, when I would love to be a husband. There are times I'd love to be a dad. Those are great gifts. But the real win is that I get to know Jesus a bit better. I love that bit in Philippians 3 where Paul says, I want to know Christ. And he's been an apostle for like 30 years at this point. He's already written the book of Romans, which presumably he understood. And they're like, Paul, I think you know Jesus. If you don't know Jesus, none of us do, I can tell you that. But what Paul is meaning is, yeah, I know Jesus. And because I know Jesus, I want to know Jesus. You can never know him enough when you're his. And Paul can think of no greater win in his own life than he might know Jesus a bit more than he does now. Amen. Time's up.